If we're going to solve difficult problems, we've got to deal with some very unpleasant truths or lies and make sure that we project to the public what the truth is.
Hard to tell the difference between truth and lies in your party, isn't it, Ken Buck?
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't. Never is.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. Stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the Bradcast, that's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience. On the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, fine affiliates all, not to mention most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly, investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. Well, this was a bit of a shocker on Tuesday. Congressman Ken Buck of Colorado, who announced last fall that he would not seek re-election this year, said on Tuesday he will resign from Congress at the end of next week.
He's not even waiting until the election.
He's out of here, man. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
How's that cold?
It's getting better.
Yeah, it'll take a few weeks, trust me. Anyway, that further shrinks the GOP's already razor-thin majority in the U.S. House. He said in a statement, quote, "Today I'm announcing that I will depart Congress at the end of next week." He said, "I look forward to staying involved in our political process, as well as spending more time in Colorado and with my family." Buck cited dysfunction on Capitol Hill in discussing his decision to leave with CNN's Dana Bash.
"Is it really that miserable right now to be? I mean, from the outside in, it doesn't look that fun. From the inside in, is it that bad that you're saying I'm done?"
"It is the worst year of the 9 years and 3 months that I've been in Congress. And having talked to former members, it's the worst year in 40, 50 years to be in Congress. But I'm leaving because I think there's a job to do out there that I want to go do."
No, it's being the worst year ever in Congress has very little to do with it.
Well, right. But here's the thing. That last part there, "I'm leaving because I think there's a job out there to do." Stick a pin in that for the moment. He went on to say this place has just evolved into this bickering and nonsense and not really doing the job for the American people, he said. And here he was a little bit later on MSNBC.
I've decided that it is time for me to do some other things. I always have been disappointed with our inability in Congress to deal with major issues. And I'm also disappointed that the Republican Party continues to, rely on this lie that the 2020 election was stolen and rely on the January 6th narrative and the political prisoners from January 6th and other things. If we're going to solve difficult problems, we've got to deal with some very unpleasant truths or lies and make sure that we project to the public what the truth is.
Okay, so good for Ken Buck is something I never thought I would say.
True.
But there you go. Ken Buck, who originally came to Congress as a Tea Party Republican, moved into the so-called Freedom Caucus once they changed their name from Tea Party to Freedom Caucus. And he said he's had enough. Good for him. For now, anyway. An additional thought, as I said, in a moment. Buck's decision to step down before the end of his term will now trim Republicans' slim edge to 218 seats over 213 for Democrats in the House, with three vacancies. With that breakdown, Republicans could only afford to lose two votes to pass any legislation, at least on a party line vote. Just two votes. Buck is a member of the ultra-right-wing so-called House Freedom Caucus, but he made a name for himself in Washington of late, breaking with his party on several major issues, notes NBC News. He criticized his fellow Republicans for echoing former President Trump's false claims that the 2020 election was stolen, has expressed doubts that Republicans have found any evidence that President Joe Biden has committed any impeachable offenses. Most recently, Buck broke with his party to become one of just three Republicans who voted against the ridiculous impeachment of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas for no crimes nor any misdemeanors, as theoretically required when impeaching, if you care about what the Constitution actually has to say about it in any case. But remember the part about, I think there's a job out there for me to do, as he told Dana Bash. CNN also reports that pressed by Bash on whether Donald Trump's status as the presumptive GOP nominee influenced his decision, Buck said, quote, "Whether he was the nominee or not, I think our system is broken in how we choose candidates, and I want to get involved in that process. Everywhere I go in Colorado," he added, "I hear that people are not happy with Trump and they're not happy with Biden," Buck said. "I'm going to find the right organization to join and I'm going to start working on that issue. We have to be better candidates up and down the ballot. So I'm going to find the right organization to join. We have to have better candidates." Does Buck think that he might be such a candidate? Now, I will note, this news just broke within the last hour or two, so I am frankly going on nothing for the moment other than his comments.
True.
Just out this afternoon. But we reported last week on how the third-party group named No Labels, a group that is secretly funded by right-wing donors, which operates in secret as far as how they do, well, how they do anything, including choosing candidates to put on the ballot. We noted last week that they were announcing that they would begin a candidate search to run a so-called unity ticket for president this year, with both a Republican and a Democrat on the ticket, supposedly on the same ticket. That even after the group was reportedly turned down previously by folks like former GOP presidential candidate Nikki Haley, Maryland's popular former Republican governor Larry Hogan, West Virginia's retiring corporatist Democratic Senator Joe Manchin. That news came last week as Arizona's corporatist Democrat turned corporatist independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema announced that she would not be running for re-election this year, clearing the way for a two-way race for the U.S. Senate in the state by Democratic Congressman Ruben Gallego and the loony MAGA election denier Carrie Lake. So I'm wondering, again, going on nothing, is Ken Buck clearing the way to actually run for president or vice president on the No Labels ticket, which has been working to get on the ballot in all 50 states and which Democrats fear will frankly, do little more than help Donald Trump return to the office if they actually put up such a ticket? For that matter, might we see a Sinema Buck ticket?
Oh, God. Exactly what no one is clamoring for.
That's right. I don't know. I don't know, but I'm just tossing that out there, at least based on some of the remarks from Buck this afternoon, who was talking a lot about, I'm leaving Congress because I want to get into the process of choosing better candidates.
Yes, like cinema, the timing and the wording of his announcement appears to suggest that he may already have some potential job prospects lined up.
We shall see.
We shall.
Laying down a marker there.
Exactly.
Speaking of Donald Trump, of a Donald Trump return to the Oval Office, the Republican National Committee on Friday formally elected Trump's personal choices of Michael Whatley and some woman named Laura Trump. Yes, that's the former president's daughter-in-law, as its new co-chairs, that its highest-ranking officers for the RNC after Trump had forced the former chair, Ronna Romney McDaniel, out of the chairmanship. Whatley is a far-right 2020 election denier who previously chaired the North Carolina GOP, and he's a an election denier, really, for not just the 2020 election, but all elections. So he ought to come in handy.
Well, you should say all elections that Republicans lose.
There you go.
Because those are the only legitimate elections for Republicans.
That's right. Beth Block, a member of the Republican National Committee from West Virginia, introduced Laura Trump at the Friday meeting, I believe this was, by politely recognizing Laura Trump's utter lack of experience for the job.
In a world where qualifications are often measured by titles and years of experience, we are reminded of a powerful truth. God does not call the qualified. He qualifies the called. Laura Trump is the embodiment of this truth.
So she's sort of saying that she's not really qualified,
right?
That's
exactly what she's saying.
And that she has no title, no years of experience, but she's called by God. Other than that, you know.
Excellent choice, guys.
Beyond being Donald Trump's daughter-in-law, she doesn't actually belong here. Anyway, Donald Trump is desperate for power. He's desperate for control. And at this point, he's most desperate for money to pay off huge legal fees and penalties. So having his own daughter-in-law take over the reins of the RNC and their bank account will be very helpful to him, no doubt, on his way toward his hoped-for autocratic rule as president beginning next year if he is successful in his quest. But, you know, you ain't seen nothing yet. Want an idea of what it's going to look like in the federal government across likely hundreds, maybe thousands of federal agencies if Donald Trump is reelected this year? Look no farther than the RNC itself, where after successfully installing his own daughter-in-law as co-chair and his own campaign finance director as the RNC's new chief of staff, on their very first day in office, as the Trump campaign took over operational control of the RNC on Monday, they immediately began what is being described as a, quote, bloodbath at the party itself. As Politico reported on Monday night, Donald Trump's newly installed leadership team at the Republican National Committee on Monday, so far their very first official weekday in office, began the process of pushing out dozens of officials. All told, the expectation is that more than 60 RNC staffers who work across the political, communications, and data departments will be let go. Those being asked to resign immediately include five members of the senior staff. Additionally, some vendor contracts are expected to be unceremoniously cut. The overhaul is aimed at cutting what one of Politico's sources described as bureaucracy at the RNC. But the move also underscores the swiftness with which Trump's operation is moving to take over the Republican Party's operation after the former president all but clinched the party's presidential nomination last week. In a letter to some political and data staff, the RNC's new chief operating officer said the new committee leadership was, quote, in the process of evaluating the organization and staff to ensure the building is aligned with its vision. During this process, certain staff are being asked to resign and then reapply for a position on the team. You know, if they're loyal enough. Under the new structure, the Trump campaign is looking to merge its operation with the RNC's. Key departments such as communications, data, and fundraising will effectively be one and the same, as dozens of workers who have run the RNC for years are unceremoniously just booted out. Daily Kos's Annie Ellie noted last night regarding all of these RNC folks who just lost their job through no fault of their own. Well, they sure could have used a union over there at the RNC to help prevent that from happening. Too bad the Republican Party hates unions and worker protections to prevent what those folks are now suddenly finding themselves dealing with. But that is, of course, precisely what Trump and his minions have said that they plan to do, that they plan for the federal government if they are allowed to take it back over beginning next year. A bloodbath at federal agencies across the board with thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of longtime government workers put out of work and replaced with Trump loyalists. You know, as autocrats and fascists and dictators do. The Trump loyalists apparently have no trouble eating their own and clearing the decks for anyone who is not seen as loyal enough to dear leader. A MAGA group seeking to oust the longtime far-right Republican speaker of the Wisconsin State Assembly, purportedly over his handling of Donald Trump's 2020 re-election loss in the state, submitted signatures on Monday in hopes of forcing a recall election of one of their own. The group, calling itself Recall Voss, said it had collected some 10,700 signatures. That is more than the roughly 7,000 signatures required from voters in the district that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss represents. The deadline for that was Monday. Quote, "The people of Racine County have spoken," said the leader of the recall effort, Matt Snorek, in a statement. "With more than 10,000 signatures on our recall petition, they've said it loud and clear. They're tired of the status quo and demand new representation." Voss, the longest-serving and arguably farthest-right assembly speaker in Wisconsin state history, who first became speaker way back in 2013, has cast doubt on the validity of the signatures. He's criticized the effort as a waste of time in a critical election year. But as the Washington Post notes, Trump supporters have been persistently targeting Voss since 2020, since the election when Trump narrowly lost in Wisconsin after he had narrowly won it 4 years earlier. Now, Voss launched an investigation into those results. But despite that, he, I guess, resisted Trump's pressure to figure out a way to overturn the outcome, as Washington Post calls it, calling it impossible and unconstitutional. In other words, Washington Post, he resisted pressure to steal the election on behalf of Donald Trump, as there has been zero evidence of widespread fraud discovered in the state, that despite Voss's own investigation, he hired a so-called special counsel, a far-right MAGA special counsel dude, to investigate the 2020 election in Wisconsin. Over several years, he found nothing, and he was ultimately let go by Voss after he had found no evidence of fraud.
And see, that's where Voss made his mistake. He actually tried to do a legitimate investigation that he could use as transparency to the public. See, I'm trying. But that's not what you're supposed to do in MAGA land. You're just supposed to submit and do as you're told and make it happen.
Yeah, and like pretend there is some such law that the state legislature can simply declare who the next president will be. In 2022, Trump backed a primary challenger to Voss. Voss, however, prevailed by a slim margin. The leader of the effort, Snorek, filed the recall petition back in January, saying Voss is, quote, blocking fair elections, unquote, which may be true, but not for the reasons that Snorek notes. Voss has been behind the last decade plus of extreme partisan gerrymanders in Wisconsin, ensuring that Democrats could never win control of either the Assembly or the state Senate, even when there were more votes cast for Democrats than Republicans. So, yeah, Voss has been blocking fair elections, but not for the reasons that I think this guy meant. Snorik also cited Voss's December 2022 comment that he will, quote, try as hard as I can to make sure Donald Trump is not the nominee in 2024. Well, that'll leave a mark, won't it?
Yes.
Voss, as they all do, has since then, even since saying that, he has said he will vote for Trump, who is now the likely GOP nominee in November. Under Wisconsin law, the target of the petition now has 10 days to challenge the signatures once they are submitted. The Wisconsin Election Commission, a bipartisan six-member panel, is ultimately responsible for deeming a petition sufficient or not and calling a special election. But whether he wins or loses a special election, Voss could be on his way out of power as Assembly Speaker, given that the Wisconsin Supreme Court recently mandated new, fairer state legislative maps that could, after more than a decade, finally see Democrats take over majorities in either one or both chambers next year. So there's that we'll be keeping our eyes on. And also on Tuesday, speaking of dear leader, former special counsel Robert Herr testified to a GOP majority House committee on Tuesday. Herr is the Trump-appointed U.S. attorney who had been tapped to serve as special counsel to investigate classified documents that Joe Biden's attorneys reported that they had found at some of Biden's old offices and elsewhere before returning them to the government. That, by way of contrast with Donald Trump, who has been charged with stealing hundreds of such documents and refusing to give them back. And by the way, evidence suggests he still has not returned all of those highly classified documents. Anyway, when Herr submitted his report last month recommending against bringing charges against Joe Biden, he made at the time what appeared to be scurrilous and otherwise wholly inappropriate claims in the report about the president's memory, which he described in various ways as fading, etc., implying that Biden was no longer fit for office or something. In any case, that's how the media read it, beginning an avalanche of articles charging that Biden's age had made him unfit for a second term and that Robert Herr, through his interviews with the president, had proven that he was no longer fit for office. Well, in advance of Herr's testimony before the House Judiciary Committee on Tuesday, the committee released the transcripts from Biden's lengthy voluntary interviews with the special counsel. And again, by way of comparison, Donald Trump refused to be interviewed by special counsel Jack Smith or any other special counsel. In this case, regarding the hundreds of pages of classified documents found recklessly stored at his Mar-a-Lago resort. But now that the actual transcripts of Joe Biden's interviews with the special counsel have been released, as AP notes in its headline today, quote, Herr said Biden couldn't recall when his son died. The interview transcript is more complicated. They write, the transcript released on Tuesday sheds new light on one of the most politically and personally sensitive episodes in Biden's term. Although the special counsel's investigation found no basis to bring criminal charges against Biden, the references to his memory threatened the president's ability to assure voters that he can keep his job. Many argue, of course, that's exactly why Robert Herr wrote the report the way he did. So I'll let others dive into the specifics on this for now of both the transcript, I think it's like 250 pages, and Herr's testimony on Tuesday in Congress. But I want to cite media critic Matt Gaetz's short Twitter thread on all of this today. Now that we're actually able to read this full transcript that Herr cited when suggesting that Biden was suffering from some sort of debilitating cognitive decline. Matt Gaetz starts with a flashback to an earlier Twitter thread citing dozens of articles and headlines from mainstream media outlets questioning Biden's age and his fitness for office following the release of HERS report last month. That thread began this way, quote, "A Trump-appointed prosecutor dropped an unfalsifiable partisan bomb on President Joe Biden Thursday, playing into a years-long right-wing media campaign, and U.S. political journalists decided to treat it as valid and an impartial charge." That's what Matt Gaetz said last month, and now that the transcript has been released, Gertz notes, the New York Times ran 30 stories about Biden's mental fitness in the 4 days following the HER report. After reviewing the transcript, however, the paper concludes that Biden, quote, fumbled with dates and the sequence of events while otherwise appearing clear-headed, unquote. Funny what happens when you look at the actual evidence, isn't it? The Washington Post, notes Gertz, ran 33 stories about Biden's mental fitness in the 4 days after the HER report was released.
33 stories in 4 days.
After viewing the transcript, he notes, the paper concludes that Biden, quote, doesn't come across as being as absent-minded as HER has made him out to be. Huh. The Wall Street Journal ran 17 stories about Biden's mental fitness in the 4 days following the HER report. After reviewing the transcript, the paper concludes it shows Biden, quote, veering into frequent digressions but not stumped on basic factual questions. Huh. By the way, I wonder if there's anyone else running for office this year who veers into frequent digressions. But I digress. In any event, what has become clear yet again is that our mainstream corporate media continues to do a wild disservice to the American people in the way that they choose to cover things and how they cover these things. And by the way, they do a great service to the lies that are being told by the right. Frankly, the bulk of the Biden campaign's time since the release of the HER report last month, apparently, the wildly misleading report by a Trump partisan, well, it was treated as if it was an accurate portrayal of the president. So since then, the Biden campaign has been working to counter the misleading, misreported message that our mainstream media sort of grabbed a hold of and ran with. As Gertz writes at Media Matters Today, in a more detailed review of all of this, he says the mainstream political press treated HER as an impartial voice, levying credible accusations, unleashing a deluge of reports calling Biden's mental acuity into question. HER's background as a former clerk to right-wing judges and a Trump administration appointee, and his gratuitous swipes at a Democratic president that happened to align with a years-long GOP campaign to portray Biden as addled, failed to raise their alarms. That sounds like our corporate media. We'd hate to let context and evidence and even time to figure out the facts. We'd hate to let any of that get in the way of, well, repeating and echoing campaign propaganda from the right. Again, that's what they do. But while we frequently call out the mainstream corporate media failures on this show, it seems only fair when we highlight when they haven't screwed up every now and again, when we can find such a moment, when they've actually done the job that we expect and frankly need them to do. An example of that, and frankly, how they can do much better, and Desi Doyen's latest Green News Report, that yes. Is all ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth.
Yes.
Just give me some truth.
Please.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth.
Yes.
Just give me some truth.
Is that too much to ask? Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Far-right MAGA Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace appeared on George Stephanopoulos' ABC This Week on Sunday to stump for Donald Trump, who she recently endorsed, despite, well, I guess briefly disavowing him after the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. But apparently all is forgiven. Nonetheless, the interview took a weird turn when Stephanopoulos asked how Mace justified endorsing a man who two different courts now have found to be liable for rape and defamation of the victim of that rape, E. Jean Carroll, in this case, to the tune of nearly $90 million in damages. And boy, did things go downhill quickly for Mace at that point. I want to play this exchange for you, however, because as much as we are, as noted, frequently critical of members of the mainstream media, Stephanopoulos here did not let Mace, who came armed with a way to distract from that question, did not let her either sidetrack from the question on the point or force him to fold, frankly, as so many of these folks do in the media. They'll ask once, if they don't get the answer they're looking for, they'll just let it go, move on to the next thing. Especially when the person they're interviewing tries to attack them for what they have asked, which is what happened here. Mace went on the attack against Stephanopoulos for daring to even raise such a question in the first place. It was really something to see. You may have seen parts of this, but let me play the full exchange and then we'll touch on a few points about it on the other side.
And you've endorsed Donald Trump for president. Mm-hmm. Judges and two separate juries have found him liable for rape and for defaming the victim of that rape. How do you square your endorsement of Donald Trump with the testimony we just saw?
Well, I will tell you, I was raped at the age of 16. And any rape victim will tell you, I've lived for 30 years with an incredible amount of shame over being raped. I didn't come forward because of that judgment and shame that I felt. And it's a shame that you will never feel, George. And I'm not going to sit here on your show and be asked a question meant to shame me about another potential rape victim. I'm not gonna do that.
It's actually not about shaming you. It's a question about Donald
Trump. No, you
are
shaming me.
You've endorsed Donald Trump for president.
Right.
What? Donald Trump has been found liable for rape by a jury. Donald Trump has been found liable for defaming the victim of that rape by a jury. It's been affirmed by a judge.
It was not a criminal court case, number one. Number two, I live with shame. And you're asking me a question about my political choices, trying to shame me as a rape victim, and I find it disgusting. And quite frankly, E. Jean Carroll's comments when she did get the judgment, joking about what she was going to buy, it makes it harder for women to come forward when they make a mockery out of rape, when they joke about it.
Doesn't it make it harder for women to come forward when they
It makes it harder when other women joke about it, and she's joked about it. I find it offensive. And I also find it offensive that you're trying to shame me with this question.
I'm not trying to shame you.
You are.
Well, in fact,
I have dealt with this for 30 years. You know how hard it was to tell my story 5 years ago when they were doing a fetal heartbeat bill and there were no exceptions for rape, incest, rape or incest in there? I had to tell my story because no other woman was coming forward.
I'm just asking.
No rape victims were represented. And you're trying to shame me this morning.
I'm just asking.
And I find it offensive. And this is why women won't come forward.
Women won't come forward because they're defamed by those who perpetrate rape. Donald
Trump. They are judged and they're shamed, and you're trying to shame me this morning.
I think
it's disgusting.
I'm not shaming you at all. I
told
you
my story. It took me 25 years to tell my story. I was judged for it. I still get judged for it today.
I'm asking you a very simple question.
You're shaming me for my political choices.
I'm asking you a question about why you endorse someone who's been found liable for rape.
It was not a criminal court. This was a civil court. And by the way, she joked about the judgment and what she was going to do with all that money. And I find that offensive.
I'm asking you
but
about
as
the man
a rape victim who's been shamed for years now because of her rape, you're trying to shame me again by asking me this political question.
You've repeated that again.
I think
again
it's offensive.
Again.
As a woman, I find it offensive.
My political choices.
I've endorsed the man that I believe is best for our country. It's not Joe Biden. And you looked at the dueling rallies yesterday in Georgia. Lakin Riley's family was with Donald Trump. They weren't with Joe Biden. The same guy yesterday that apologized for calling her killer an illegal, who wasn't illegal. And here you are trying to shame a rape victim. I find it disgusting.
I mean, you keep saying I'm shaming you.
The question is.
How is the question asking you about a presidential candidate who's
You're asking a rape victim.
And there's no question about that. And you've courageously talked about
that. Because I've been raped. I think that's disgusting.
No, I'm questioning your political choices because you're supporting someone who's been found liable for rape. Actually, I'm not trying to shame you.
That's exactly
you're not answering
you're
the question.
I think it's disgusting.
Well, you're welcome to say that, but you also have to answer the question. Why are you supporting someone who's been found liable for rape?
I just answered your question.
What is the answer?
He was not found guilty in a criminal court of law. It was sexual abuse. It wasn't actually rape, by the way. And E. Jean Carroll joked about all the money she's going to get and made a mockery out of this case. And I think that's offensive. There's a reason why women don't come forward. And when you have someone who says that they're raped and they make a mockery out of this civil court judgment, it's offensive to other women. It makes it harder for other women to come forward when another woman has made a mockery of it.
You said women don't come forward because they are afraid. They are afraid
they're
because they're defamed
by those and shamed.
You're trying to shame me this morning. They are afraid to come forward, as you said, because they are defamed by those who commit the rape. That's what Donald Trump has been found guilty of doing.
He defended himself over that and denies that it ever happened, but he was not found guilty in a criminal court of law. It was a civil judgment.
So is that the distinction you're making?
Abuse.
A civil judgment is okay, but a criminal judgment
is not.
This
is different.
Unbelievable.
Wow. It's not legitimate, right? Because it doesn't count because it was in a civil court, not a criminal court. I mean, really?
Now, Des, I had some thoughts, obviously. There's a lot there to unpack. But
yes.
When we first listened to that, you immediately made a point that had not initially jumped out at me. Mace was actually doing exactly what she was actually accusing Stephanopoulos of doing.
Yes, she was defaming and shaming a rape victim, E. Jean Carroll.
She was going on, oh, well, the things she said, the things money she was, what she was going
to
do
she
with that money,
how dare
she? She
dared to make a joke about it, yeah. I find that so offensive.
She was shaming E. Jean Carroll.
Yes, and then claiming that the rape wasn't legitimate. She didn't use those words, but she implied it was not legitimate because it was settled in a civil court rather than a criminal court because, you know, there's a statute of limitations, lady.
And it was a unanimous verdict in those civil two juries. I guess there is a difference in the standard of evidence. It's a preponderance of evidence versus beyond a doubt or whatever it is.
Right.
But they were both unanimous verdicts. And she also goes on to say it wasn't rape. Well, in fact, it wasn't rape under New York laws at the time, back in the 90s. And I'm not going to go into the distinctions because this is a family show. So I'm not going to go into the distinctions of what makes what he did at the time. Yes, indeed, rape under today's law in New York. So when she says, "Oh, it wasn't rape," yeah, it was rape. So huge credit, frankly, to Stephanopoulos there for not falling for her attempts
to deflect.
Yeah, and sidestep the question
and attack him
and attack him
for daring to ask somebody who is a rape victim a question. Oh my God,
it's disgusting.
It's offensive.
And frankly, for his persistence in coming back to it, no matter what, for I think that was, what, 4.5 minutes?
Oh, yes. And it went on from there. That was not the end of it.
And that's an entirety, an eternity, I'm sorry, in network TV, even cable TV. That was network TV. 4.5 minutes at least. And so she was not only victim shaming E. Jean Carroll, she was trying to shame Stephanopoulos for even asking the question by claiming that she was being victim shamed, which was simply ridiculous. So good on him for not folding after trying once or twice and moving on, but staying with it and underscoring just what she was trying to get away with. And all he wanted to know is, how do you justify it? How do you justify supporting that guy?
And he repeated several times, which I'm very glad he did, women don't come forward because they are defamed by those who perpetrate rape. They are defamed by the rapist. So Nancy Mace knows all of this. She knows she is lying. She knows she's attacking a rape victim. She knows she's trying to shame a rape victim. And she's doing it. And she knows she's trying to excuse someone who has been adjudicated a rapist. And she knows all of these are lies. And she's still doing it anyway because it benefits her politically.
So I just wanted to, you know, we are usually so critical of media for failing to do the job that we need them to do. I wanted to at least cite, at least in this one instance, when they hung in there and did the right thing and didn't, you know, let these folks get away with, we'll leave it there for now at the end. So good on George. At least in this case, please keep it up. I do suspect Donald Trump will not be going on George Stephanopoulos' show anytime soon.
Yeah.
By the way, E. Jean Carroll, for her part, as Daily Kos's Walter Einenkel noted, chose to offer grace to Nancy Mace after that. She, Carroll wrote on Twitter, quote, "Thank you, George Stephanopoulos, for valiantly defending me. I wish Representative Nancy Mace well. And I salute all survivors for their strength, endurance, and holding on to their sanity."
And May still hasn't really actually explained how she squares her endorsement of Donald Trump with his being adjudicated a rapist.
Einenkel goes on to note that Mace is no stranger to endorsing Republican men who have allegedly failed sexual abuse survivors. After helping to oust Kevin McCarthy from the speakership in 2023, she threw her support behind Congressman Jim Jordan. But when CNN's Jake Tapper asked her about the allegations that Jordan remained silent about years of alleged sexual abuse of multiple young men while he was a wrestling coach at Ohio State University, Mace responded, quote, "Yeah, I don't know anything. I don't know anything about that." I guess she had not yet thought of the pretend victim shaming card that she could have used at the time. But that's enough giving kudos to the media for today. Again, that instance was a rare success. Our friend and longtime media critic Dan Frumkin, however, via his Press Watchers newsletter a few weeks ago, he put together something that frankly is long overdue that I'd like to share just a few samples from today. It is what he calls his, quote, "proposed additions to the New York Times style guide to improve its political coverage." Dan has been good since I first pointed out to him about, for example, not using the phrase like trying to overturn or reverse the 2020 election, that what Team Trump was actually doing was trying to steal the election, and words like that make a big difference. Frumkin now tends to use that word when he describes what Trump tried to do. And here in these proposed additions to the Times style guide, he offers a bunch of other examples where the Times and other mainstream media outlets really need to do better in how they report facts. He begins, quote, "The New York Times repeatedly abuses the English language in its political reporting. I decided it needs some additions to its style guide." That's the guide that Times reporters are supposed to use when using or not using certain words or phrases in their coverage. And Frumkin goes through a whole bunch of them that he is suggesting they add to their guide, citing the proper and improper uses of those words or phrases, using quotes from the New York Times, their actual coverage in recent months, for examples of how to or how not to use a number of these words in their coverage. I'll link to the whole thing so you can read it. But for example, the word baseless. He notes baseless means lacking foundation in fact, like lack of evidence, no clear evidence, or unproven. It does not carry with it an implication of deception. So he recommends do not use these terms to contextualize a claim that is actually false, specious, spurious, and or intentionally deceptive. It is insufficient.
So don't use baseless when what you really mean is deceptive or specious.
He says, here's an example of improper uses. And all these examples come from the New York Times themselves. He quotes their use of, quote, baseless claims of voter fraud. Quote, baseless theories that Mr. Trump had been the actual winner of the election. So excellent point. These claims and theories, they're not baseless. They're indeed false and specious and intentionally deceptive, and they should be described as such as opposed to baseless claims. A baseless claim. Here's another one. The word Congress. Only refer to Congress or the House or the Senate when referring to them as institutions or possibly to a unanimous vote. Do not suggest that Congress is somehow responsible for what is actually the work of one party or one faction in Congress. Readers cannot hold the right people accountable if we don't tell them who's responsible. So he quotes again from the New York Times, proper usage, quote, hard right grinds House to a halt, rebuking McCarthy for the debt deal. This was back in June of last year. Improper usage, quote, time is running out for Congress to raise the debt ceiling. That from an original headline in May of last year. Time is running out for Republicans to do so in that instance, since they're the ones who are controlling what gets voted on in the House. And they are the ones who are holding up such votes by preventing them from even coming to the floor, where they would otherwise be passed most likely with the help of Democrats, who are not being allowed to vote on those things. But by, you know, charging that it's Congress running out of time, frankly, they're letting the bad actors off the hook. It matters. It's important. And here, of course, is one of my favorites, which you probably know if you spent any time listening to this program or reading bradblog.com over the years, where I will not use the word, this word, if it is not appropriate, at least without putting, you know, scare quotes around it. The word is conservative. Frumkin writes, do not use conservative to describe people who are not conservative. For instance, extremists, Christian nationalists, and authoritarians are not conservative. Conservatives believe in limited government, states' rights, personal freedom, personal integrity. Donald Trump is not a conservative. Neither is the movement he leads, and neither anymore is the party that he leads, especially not its right flank. For MAGA in general, and for the anti-gay, anti-immigrant movement in particular, use instead far right, extreme right, extremist, Christian nationalist, or fascist, and describe their preferred policies as regressive, authoritarian, radical, or intolerant. Yes, please. Thank you, Dan Frumkin. Will the New York Times pay attention to his additions to the New York Style Guide? That remains to be seen. I'll just drop a couple more. Again, I will link to the full thing so you can read it. And he's actually asking for further suggestions to add to the guide. But here's one. The word falsehoods. Only use falsehoods when you have already used the word lie too often. Good advice. Here's another one. Moderate. Do not describe someone as moderate just because on one or two issues there is some daylight between them and their extremists in the party. That would be like describing Ken Buck, who is not running for re-election, who said he's going to actually be resigning next week. That would be like describing Ken Buck as a moderate. He is not a moderate simply because he disagrees that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. That would be ridiculous. But, as Liz Cheney, well, she's a moderate. She's a moderate in her party. A moderate is, from Knotes, is someone who represents centrist views, who has principles that trump partisanship. Frumkin adds, there are currently no moderate elected officials among House Republicans.
Excellent point.
Excellent point. Excellent additions to the New York Times style guide, if only they would bother to read them and or follow them. Good luck to you, Dan. Thank you for putting them out there. All right, quick break and we're back. Desi Doyen, it's the Green News Report.
Yay,
that's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Just a quick thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help Desi Doyen and I stay on your public airwaves. You're the only thing that keeps us on those public airwaves. We don't rely on corporate support or political support. We rely on you, and your support is needed now more than ever. At bradblog.com/donate. Thank you. A lot of melting going on.
Yes, that's true.
This time of year, it's only March. We shouldn't be to the full melting process for another few weeks, it seems to me, and especially in a whole bunch of places in the northern part of this country and around the globe.
Yes, it's rather stunning.
That have been seeing, yes, incredible, stunning heat this year, as discussed in our latest Green News Report.
I'm taking the most significant action ever on climate in the history of the world.
In State of the Union address, President Biden highlights economic and jobs boom from his climate policies. February 2024 obliterated global temperature and ocean heat records, plus Great Barrier Reef hit with yet another mass bleaching event.
All of those disturbing events and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We're also making history by confronting the climate crisis, not denying it. I don't think any of you think there's no longer a climate crisis. At least I hope you don't.
Keep hope alive, Mr. President. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, a new month is beginning to get underway. Therefore, numbers are coming in from the previous month, and they are as troubling as we feared they might be.
Yes, indeed. Winter was weirdly warm for half of the world's population, with unusual heat from Siberia to South America, Africa to Australia. That's according to an analysis of temperature data from hundreds of locations worldwide by Climate Central. The researchers also concluded that man-made climate change played a recognizable role in the winter heat waves in cities worldwide. It was also the hottest February ever recorded globally since records began in the mid-1800s. February was the ninth straight consecutive month of record monthly temperatures, according to Europe's climate agency, Copernicus. Copernicus also confirmed that global ocean temperatures in February were at an all-time high for any time of year. Scientists say most of the record heat is driven primarily by the burning of fossil fuels, with a boost from a natural El Nino weather pattern in the Pacific Ocean. For the U.S. specifically, the lower 48 states just had their warmest winter in 130 years of record keeping, according to new NOAA data, with record-setting temperatures particularly affecting the northern third of the country. Winters are warming faster than any other season in the U.S., with the coldest places seeing the biggest increase. It was a lost winter, with bizarrely warm winter temperatures and record low ice cover on the Great Lakes. The lack of winter cold cold and snow has profound implications for cold weather crops and water supplies.
Yeah, the only problem is a lot of people say, oh, it's great. Winter hasn't been terrible at all this year.
Yeah, but it has impacts. In Canada, a new study warns that rising winter temperatures mean that the country's previously reliable ice roads are likely to become unusable in coming years, threatening vital deliveries of fuel and food.
Because if the lakes don't freeze, the truckers can't get across them, can't make these deliveries out to these very, very rural communities around Canada.
Exactly. In Australia, the iconic Great Barrier Reef is suffering another mass bleaching event. The reef's managers confirmed on Friday an unprecedented fifth mass coral bleaching event in just 8 years, the result of soaring ocean temperatures caused by the global climate crisis and El Nino. Coral bleaching occurs when heat stress forces corals to expel the colorful algae that live within it, leading to bleaching. Multiple bleach events in quick succession can kill coral. Worse, NOAA announced this week that ongoing marine heat waves around the world are triggering widespread, large-scale coral bleaching nearly everywhere, noting that multiple major reef regions have, quote, put the world on the precipice of a global bleaching event. And that matters because coral reefs support at least 25% of marine species and provide food and economic security for hundreds of millions of people.
So when the coral dies, the fish die, and... Well, we won't talk about the people yet.
Lots of cascading consequences.
Indeed.
Finally, in U.S. politics, amid all of these global warming milestones, President Biden didn't spend much time on climate change or energy policy during his State of the Union address to Congress last week. Instead, he focused more on the economic impact of the boom in U.S. clean energy manufacturing and jobs across the country generated by his landmark climate legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act. And he also highlighted the stark contrast between Democrats and Republicans on climate policy and for their climate science denial.
I'm taking the most significant action ever on climate in the history of the world. I'm cutting our carbon emissions in half by 2030, creating tens of thousands of clean energy jobs like the IBEW workers building and installing 500,000 electric vehicle charging stations. Conserving 30% of America's lands and waters by 2030. And taking action on environmental justice, fence line communities smothered by the legacy of pollution.
However, polling suggests that voters have little knowledge of Biden's flagship Inflation Reduction Act climate bill. Only 3 in 10 Americans know much about it, the largest single investment in climate action in U.S. history.
Those are the 3 in 10 that listen to the Green News Report. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
You don't know, Jack. You tell me that you do. You don't know, Jack.
Mm-hmm.
I know you really don't.
Now, to be clear, the ones who don't know Jack are the ones who do not listen to the Green News Report.
Correct.
Or the broadcast.
That's right.
Everyone who does listen to the...
is well informed and very handsome or pretty.
And knows Jack.
And very smart.
There you go. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you can download all of them for free anytime at bradblog.com. Hey, while you're there, please consider hitting one of those donate buttons to help us support our efforts to stay on your public airwaves. Or you can just go straight to bradblog.com/donate. At least if you know Jack. Don't know that makes any sense. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
If you think I didn't mean it, then you don't know Jack.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2012. That was the day OSHA released its memorandum titled Employer Safety Incentive and Disincentive Practices. It addressed compliance officers and whistleblower investigators. It touched on employer practices that discourage the reporting of injuries and illnesses on the job. The memorandum stated that employee reporting is a protected right. It also asserted that employer discouragement could constitute a violation of whistleblower statutes like 11C of the OSHA Act and record-keeping regulations. OSHA emphasized that the likelihood of discouragement and discrimination increases when safety programs are linked to lower reported injuries and illnesses. The memorandum outlines four common scenarios. One, when an employer disciplines workers injured on the job, employees must have a way to report injuries and illnesses. Two, when an employer disciplines workers for the time or manner in which they report an injury. Three, when a worker is disciplined for an injury as a result of violating a safety rule. OSHA asks, does the employer monitor the workplace regularly for safety compliance? Does the employer mete out discipline equally, regardless of injury? And finally, the memorandum stresses the need to examine the kind of safety program implemented. Does the program provide incentives to dissuade workers from reporting injuries and illnesses? Are prizes and bonuses awarded when reported injuries decrease? Discouraging and disciplining workers for reporting could be considered unlawfully discriminatory. It also violates the employer's obligation to document injuries and illnesses. OSHA notes there are positive ways to implement safety practices. Examples include rewarding workers who identify hazards, participate in investigations, and offer suggestions on how to make the job safer or complete safety training.